This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, October 21st, the Norris Group proudly presents its 9th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Doug Duncan. Doug is Fannie Mae's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist. He is responsible for providing all forecasts and analysis on the economy, housing, and mortgage markets for Fannie Mae. Duncan also oversees corporate strategy and is responsible for strategic research regarding external factors and their potential impact on the company and the housing industry. He serves as the chair of the Fannie Mae Corporate House Price Forecast Committee, named one of Bloomberg Businessweek's 50 most powerful people in real estate. Duncan is Fannie Mae's source for information analysis on the external business and economic environment, the applications or the implications of changes in the economic environment to the company's strategy and execution, and forecasting for housing activity, demographics, overall economic activity, and mortgage market activity. Doug, we welcome you back to our show.
Thanks. Great to be back.
I'm just curious, external factors, would you say they play less or more of a role than they used to?
I don't know that they that it's either. They're just different.
Okay.
So, one external factor that was actually generated by an internal factor is the collapse of oil prices. But we weren't talking about that even 2 years ago. We were thinking $100 to $120 a barrel. Today, we're thinking less than $50, driven by the fracking development
right
within the United States, which has changed the global dynamic of oil. So that's a pretty big global or external factor, but related to internal. Other externals, there's always some sort of geopolitical turmoil. It may be more intense or less intense at different points in time. It's probably more intense right now with ISIS and the international military relationships being tested by ISIS. There's always change in the global trade driven by the prospects of individual countries. For 20 years, China was the story at the margin for resource extraction. Countries that were commodity-specific did very well. China clearly slowing sustainably for some time, taking the heat out of global commodities prices. So those are all external factors. But if you go back 20 years, that would have been a different set. If you went 20 years before that, a different set. The impact of something like World War One or World War Two, which was an all-encompassing global thing, that's a different ballgame.
Okay. What has been the impact of, if any, negative sovereign debt in maybe 30-35% of the world's debt?
Yeah. I think it's even more than that. I think if you take the United States out of it, I think over 50% of sovereign debt around the globe is paying negative interest rates out to a 10-year time frame. It's an experiment, a monetary policy experiment. It's very difficult to see that there's been any positive impact on that. And as you know, the United States has not participated in that. I think we saw coming out of the Jackson Hole discussions last week, a pretty significant reticence to run that experiment in the United States. So it's not clear that it's been beneficial. I think there's this schism between the potential of monetary policy to accomplish broad-based goals versus whether those central banks are being asked to do things which are rightly in the fiscal policy arena. And I think that the negative interest rates on sovereign debt are, to me, an indication that that's a bridge too far for monetary policy.
If I look at the charts that exist, I have a 10-year T-bill at approximately 1.6. I have an unemployment rate that is almost full employment at 4.8 or 9, and we have a 1% GDP growth. I don't think those three charts have ever coincided at those numbers before. So what is that telling us?
It tells us that we continue to see the weakest economic recovery that we've seen since World War II. I think the third quarter number, everybody's going to get excited about that because it looks like a jump in the third quarter on an annualized basis. But to your point, if you go back to the prior three quarters, it was basically 1% growth, which means it takes a very small shock to put you into a recession. To me, this is makes the point I was just suggesting, which is that the Fed has been asked to do the job which really needs to be done by fiscal policy. And in fact, a very low interest rate posture makes the decision by the White House and the Congress not to address the deeper fiscal issues easier, in the sense that it holds the cost of the public debt artificially low.
Absolutely.
Making it seem as though it's not costly.
Right. Your monthly nut is variable, so it can grow by the trillions, and it's not a problem.
Right. That's right. And it's, you know, Washington is not good at making hard decisions on the fiscal policy side. And so it's easy to attempt to deflect to monetary policy, where the decision makers are not elected but are appointed. And so they don't have to go through the democratic process, which the Congress and the White House do.
Do you see that changing after the election, that we were going to get responsible fiscally?
Given the level of discourse and the subject matter in discourse through the campaign at this point, I would say I'm not overly hopeful.
Okay.
However, at some point, the hand is going to be forced, because our fiscal posture and the trend lines are not sustainable into the future. So the base economics is going to force the issue eventually.
They're sustainable longer if interest rates are nothing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But also, bear in mind, insurance companies need positive yield to meet their contractual obligations. Pensions need positive yields too. So there is a cost that eventually is going to get to be very painful in the private sector and in the public benefit sector, that will make this a much bigger issue if we don't get back to a more normal interest rate environment sometime soon.
It sounds like that we probably are going to break some promises. Would that be accurate to say?
Well, the longer we go without addressing the economic sustainability of the promises that have been made, the more likely the answer is yes.
When I look at charts again, it looks like, you know, it seems like my whole life we've been making sure that inflation is in check. When I look at charts today, I look at a series of charts that tells me most people are trying to prevent deflation. Is that inaccurate?
No, I think that's been the central bank mantra, is concern that inflation is not high enough, which by inference suggests that the potential for deflation is too high. So you heard some discussion again in Jackson Hole about whether or not the Fed, the United States Central Bank, would be willing to tolerate inflation rates higher than their stated 2% target. And so that's a reflection of the fact that they consider deflation to be a bigger issue, a bigger risk than inflation, at least in the near term.
Right. Has Japan been playing kind of an advanced game of that, trying to create inflation, creating enormous debt, yet not ever getting to the inflation concern, still preventing deflation? So are they?
Yeah, they're the poster child. And there are a couple of data points. Their debt to GDP ratio is about 250%. There's a kind of general consensus among economists that if you get past somewhere in the 90% debt to GDP level, that sustainably slows economic growth. So at 250% debt to GDP, it's difficult to see how you come out of that. The second thing to note is that their capital market basically is their central bank.
Right.
At this point, it's bought up the debt. So in the absence of their central bank, they don't really have capital markets. A third thing is they have the world's, among the developed countries of the world, they have the world's worst demographics.
Exactly.
Which means that they simply can't grow out of it from a population and productivity number. It is somewhat concerning on one hand, but you can understand it on the other hand, that they're going to address the question of whether they should change the Constitution, which today, as I understand it, limits defense spending to 1% of GDP at the most, and a request to increase defense spending to up to 3% of GDP. Well, it's very clear what the one form of government spending that has an immediate stimulus effect is defense spending, because it goes directly into production, directly into the field. So it is the most impactful. So to the extent that that part of that change is an attempt to stimulate economic activity, that could generate some additional growth. On the other hand, it's also a reflection of tensions in Southeast Asia with the rise of China and some of their view on their influence in Southeast Asia. So, you know, it has both a potential plus and a minus in terms of that geopolitics, which we were talking about earlier.
Coinciding with the demographics, they don't really have a very friendly immigration policy.
Yeah, their birth rate is 1.3. Replacement birth for any society is 2.1 per birthing age woman, and they don't allow immigration. So it's just awfully hard to see how they're going to fix that.
And yet in the last, and I don't know the time frame exactly, but the Japanese currency has strengthened in the last year or so, correct?
It has. it's a little bit of a mystery.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one that's baffled.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. On the housing side, let's talk a little bit about our housing. We're down to about 63% owner occupancy. So what do you think the powers that be think of that percentage? Is that about right? I'm glad we got there. Or are they looking for policies that might help that out?
So I was at a meeting maybe a year ago in which somebody asked me, what do you think is the right home ownership rate? And I said, it's the rate at which all of the credit qualified households who want to own a home do own a home. And I had thought that was a fairly uncontroversial statement, but it turns out that there was some controversy around that.
Really?
I think it comes from the point of view that housing is, in every country, developed and undeveloped, a part of social policy. And, you know, we have things like the tax preferences, the capital gains tax preference, the mortgage interest deduction. We have other things on the multifamily side, the low-income housing tax credits, and things like that that are intended to spur and in some way subsidize housing. So the United States is not immune from housing as part of social policy. The question is, what's the right balance? And I think you're seeing pressure now. As I warned in a speech 2 years ago, I said, be careful, as the delinquency problem declines, you'll see a response in the political ideas space to the fact that underwriting criteria tightened as a result of the crisis, and that's going to lead to calls for easing of conditions or subsidy or some things like that. You should expect that will happen, and that certainly is something that's happening as we speak. I'm not surprised by that, but it will take some creativity, I think, to make sure that all of any inappropriate barriers are removed, but that credit standards are maintained.
It's an interesting time to be at 63% instead of, say, 69, with 6% less. What does each percentage of that represent in numbers of people? And I'm asking that off the cuff, so if you don't know, that's understandable. But how many?
Yeah, I think, right off the top of my head, I think we have about 135 million households. So 1% of that would be 1.4 million.
So 10 million people approximately are now paying rent as opposed to paying a mortgage, which is interesting because in a sense that's given them a variable housing cost, which is their biggest bill. So their biggest bill is no longer fixed. It's going to go up. And I'm just curious, how does that affect an economy?
Obviously, housing services can be provided either through owner occupancy or through rental. So you still have a production function on both sides, and it's the production that generates generates values, which ultimately the consumers consume. You see the capture of the owner occupancy piece compared to the rental piece in the CPI inflation measure through what's called the owner's equivalent rent.
Okay.
Basically, they make a conversion of what would it cost you to rent the house that you own if you had to rent it. And so, actually, that's been the most rapidly rising component of CPI recently, and it comes from the fact that there's a supply problem on both the homes being built for purchase by owner-occupants and on apartment buildings at the low end of the cost spectrum. And so what's happening is that the fact that the entry-level homes are not being built means that people, in order to save up money to buy the higher cost homes, have to rent longer, but the people building apartment buildings are not building entry-level apartments. They're building Class A apartments, where the higher cost apartments. So when those new households go into those apartments, they're paying higher than cyclically normal rents, which means it takes them longer to save the money to buy their first home, which is now not the typical entry-level home. There's this sort of a negative circle there.
Do renters or homeowners generally spend more for housing?
Homeowners generally have more housing-related expenses because when you buy a house, you tend also to buy a bunch of other things that go with the house, like couches and carpet and curtains and all that. When you move into an apartment, you have less of those things because it's not yours, and some of those things are actually provided as a component of the apartment. So the multiplier effect on economic activity is greater in the owner occupancy purchased homes.
We've seen one of the longest expansions in the economy over the last 8 years. Do you see a recession in the next few years? And if so, what impact might that recession have on our real estate?
Yeah, I'm not in the camp that believes that the business cycle has been repealed. So if we still have a business cycle, we will have a recession. No one's forecast has a recession in it now, but that's one of the things that macroeconomists are the poorest at, is forecasting the onset of recession. It's sort of like the bank regulators who report out that bank capital is adequate, and it is until it's not.
Right.
With growth at this year, we think growth of the full year will come in at about 1.8%. That it doesn't take much to tip you into recession. And one of the questions is if that did happen, and I've given a couple of scenarios, one of which, while it's not in our formal forecast, I could see circumstances coming together for there to be a recession, say in the second half of 2017. What would that look like? Well, it really depends from a housing perspective what happens to unemployment. If it's relatively mild, let's say unemployment goes to 7%, housing might actually do reasonably well. I just was explaining that there's a shortage of entry-level housing. If unemployment rises, and that shortage in the presence of the unemployment rate, which you talked about earlier, being down around less than 5%, has meant household formation has picked up, putting more demand pressure and leading to real house price appreciations about 3 to 4 times the normal over the long run. So unemployment rises to 7%. That demand pressure eases, but there's still sufficient demand for builders to keep building. So the price appreciation slows, and interest rates are certainly not going to go up in a recession. That might mean that housing actually does pretty well in a recessionary environment, and it's other sectors that have more difficulty. Maybe, for example, in the financial sector, but mortgage continues to get pretty good treatment relative to the underlying treasuries. So that's one way that it could play out. The question is, what would be the shock that would generate that? A real serious reset in China. They're coming up on, I think, one of their 5-year plenums where the Communist Party gets together to set the next 5-year plan. If there were some significant disruption in that and China were to even more dramatically slow, that could be a triggering event. Another triggering event, we'll see in the Italian election. That may have a lot to do with what happens to the health of banking within the EU, because some of the Italian banks are in very difficult straits. That could be a trigger. So it's hard to say.
Doug, we are out of time. It's been great talking with you again. Thank you for all the great information, and we look forward to having you on our panel at the I Survived event.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Safe travels.
Thank you.
All right.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Auction.com, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA Green Designs, LA South Rhea, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Orange County Building Industry Association, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Realty Executives Inland Empire, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Wholesale Capital Corporation, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.